Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. I am here today on behalf of Mr. Salem Lake. And before I begin, I'd like to say that we appreciate and are aware of the deferential standards of review that are employed by this Court on questions such as these. That said, it is our belief, bolstered by the authorities, that even under these deferential standards of review, the decisions below simply cannot stand. With respect to the warrant at issue and the District Court's failure to suppress that warrant, the facts are clear and undisputed. The sole basis for this warrant comes from statements of a first-time informant. This informant had no track record of cooperation. The police did little of legal import to corroborate his statements. There was no controlled buys. There was no monitoring of my client's house. There was nothing under the case law that would substantiate the testimony of a first-time informant. The warrant also...
Of course, you know, when you take a look at Korth, we explicitly held there that an affidavit from an informant of unknown reliability can still establish probable cause.
I think the key holding of Korth, Your Honor, is that it looks at the totality of the circumstances. And under the totality of the circumstances here, when you look even beyond the fact that this was a first-time informant, there are critical deficiencies with this warrant. For example, the warrant omits details, critical details, about the confidential informant. It describes the confidential informant, and I would say opaquely, as a cooperating individual. It does not describe him as a recently arrested felon or someone with a very serious drug habit. With respect to the recently arrested felon characteristic, that is a characteristic that this court in Olson...
But didn't the affidavit... Tell me if I'm wrong here. Didn't the affidavit detail that he was a purchaser and user of narcotics?
It did, and there's a problem with that as well, if I may.
But how is that materially different from that he was a narcotics addict and had previously been arrested for possession of narcotics?
He was not only arrested for possession of narcotics, Judge, he was arrested, I believe, for domestic battery as recently as, I think, a few weeks ago prior to his cooperation.
But why would you need that in this affidavit?
Well, under Olson, where you have someone who's so opaquely described with no track record, someone who's been previously or recently arrested, it merits a greater degree of skepticism by the issuing judge. Here, that skepticism was not applied. Frankly, no scrutiny was applied. And when you look at how the affidavit describes this cooperating individual, it says that he had been buying crack cocaine during the past 10 years from my client. Now, my client had been in prison up until a few months prior to his arrest. Now, the government's position is that is factually accurate, and it's a truthful statement. Now,
wasn't he in and out of prison?
He wasn't
in prison for that whole period.
He was in prison for day. He was in prison up until a few months prior to his arrest, Your Honor. He may have been in and out, but for the bulk of 10 years, I believe he was incarcerated. But the government's position is that this is a factually accurate statement. It's truthful. I admit I do not practice in this area often. I'm mostly a securities lawyer, and I refer to that, my experience there. Imagine if a company were to say in its public filings that it has made money during the past 10 years, when in fact it had only made money in the last month. I doubt that the government would say that that's an accurate statement or would be making the position it is here. Now, I understand this is an uphill battle, but the problem is, I think, magnified when you look at what the issuing judge did. And the record says she didn't do much. She remembered next to nothing about her meeting with the informant. She admitted error. She admitted that she didn't follow procedures. And when she was presented with this warrant, it was not the picture of someone who had been recently arrested or someone who had, frankly, the type of problems that merited deeper scrutiny.
Didn't the police officer show her the defendant's rap sheet?
Her testimony didn't substantiate that.
Well, but somebody testified to that.
That's correct. Officer Del Bosque did testify to that, but she has no recollection. The only recollection she has is that it was dark in the car, there were errors made with the warrant, and that she didn't follow her usual process.
But wasn't the court entitled to find reliability based on the detailed description of the premises and the statements against his penal interests?
Well, with respect to the statements of detail, for the most part, the detail could have come from other sources. And I think the real issue here is magnified by the way in which this decision was treated by the district court. There was no citation to authority. There was no written opinion. The only thing we have from the lower court, from Judge Holderman, is a statement that this is a close call and that it disturbed him. And there's no real reference to any of these things. And I wish to point out that testimony could have been elicited about the detail of his affidavit and the problems with the way in which law enforcement went about in procuring this warrant had Mr. Lake been allowed to cross-examine or question Mr. Ali during the suppression hearing. That was not afforded to him. Now, we recognize that it is a substantially it's a very difficult standard to argue that the government should immunize or the court should do something sua sponte vis-a-vis a witness. But the point is clear that this warrant was rife with errors. And the treatment by the district court, referring to it cursorily as a close call with no substantiation, no citation to case law, I think even under the more deferential standards, fails to pass muster. We've also raised a second issue with respect to the court and the jury's finding that my client was in possession of crack cocaine. This court, in its recent precedent, has provided a definition for the process by which crack cocaine is made. This definition in the Edwards case has been followed by the district court, notably in the Partee case. What is unprecedented here is that the government tested the substance in question twice, not once, but twice, and did not find any sodium bicarbonate or, frankly, any adulterant that is found in crack cocaine.
You suppose it was?
Well, it was cocaine-based. That's what it was. That was what was established. And if there is a difference, as there is according to this case's, you know, this court's precedent, between cocaine base and crack, and I believe if you look at the Booker case, the 2001 Booker case,
what did they think they were buying?
Well, the record is that they believe that they were buying rock. The street name, obviously, for rock is crack cocaine. But I think we make this point in our brief that if the term crack is to have meaning, and this court has made clear that it does, there has to be some standard applied apart from something that is vague and inarticulate and that can change from matter to matter.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any authority that says that the government has to show or prove the presence of sodium bicarbonate or sodium chloride in order to identify a substance as crack? And then did you suggest that there might be a jury instruction to that effect? But what authority do you have on that?
Well, I think the closest authority we have, Judge Williams, is the Edwards case, which describes the process of creating crack cocaine as a process by which cocaine hydrochloride is mixed with sodium bicarbonate, boiled until the mixture results in a solid subject.
Are you talking about that unreported Northern District of Illinois case?
It is not unreported. I believe it's from March of 06. So during our briefing, it had not been entered into the federal supplement recorded. But that is the case I'm talking about. Yes.
Which is not binding on us.
Mm-hmm. Correct. It's not binding.
Well, that's why I asked if you had any binding authority.
I don't. And the only authority I would refer the court to is the Edwards case. And I recognize that Edwards does not describe or does not hold that sodium bicarbonate is a requisite. But if that is the case, I also instruct the court to look at Booker. The Booker case, decided in 2001, basically held that a cocaine-based substance was cracked because there was an adulterant found. Here, we have anecdotal evidence, the testimony of one crack user, surmounting chemical tests that prove that the substances that are, even under the sentencing guidelines, usually present in crack, were not here. I reserve the remainder of my time for my rebuttal, unless the panel has any further questions.
I just want to note that the DEA chemist who testified as to the absence of the sodium bicarbonate also testified that it would not necessarily be present in crack.
If I may rejoin her to that, Your Honor, the DEA agent also noted that he would not be able to identify the substance as crack by looking at it, which is, frankly, one of the key pieces of the government's case against my client. If I may, I'll reserve my time.
Good Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, April Perry on behalf of the United States. To begin with the crack issue, the reason the chemist testified that he would not be able to tell it was crack just by looking at it is that because there is no chemical definition for crack. By its nature, a scientist cannot determine it, and that is why this court has repeatedly held that the true experts in crack cocaine are the people who are on the street and the people who are using it. And that's why in this case we had Charles Frazier's testimony, an individual who had been an addict for most of his life. He said on cross-examination that he had used and abused crack for as long as he could remember, and he also said that he had smoked crack the defendant had given him the night before the search warrant was executed in this case. That testimony, coupled with the testimony that the defendant in his post-arrest statements tried to explain to the law enforcement officers where he buys his rock from, was sufficient in this case to prove that the substance at issue was crack cocaine. And we would urge this court to hold that sodium bicarbonate does not need to be present, that this is a street term, it is not a chemical one. Chemists cannot define it, and we would continue to prove it up by the use of the people on the streets, the people who've seen it, the people who have had experience with it, and in this case, the people who actually smoked it.
Well, we don't have any evidence, do we, of having someone smoked the particular cocaine base that was seized from the bedroom?
Well, it's hard to tell from the record.
Right.
We know that the defendant gave it to him. We also know that there's no evidence that the defendant was handing out multiple types of drugs.
Right. We don't know exactly what pile it came from, if any.
Well, we know it came from the defendant.
Right.
We only found one type of controlled substance in his apartment. So from that, we would argue that it's a reasonable inference for the jury to make that he is distributing crack.
But that wasn't the same day. Was it?
It wasn't. It was no. It was at least the day before, and it's a little unclear as to when exactly he got it. But he testified that he would rent his room to anyone who would give him a rock and $10, and that is apparently what he did in this case, and I think it was a reasonable inference for the jury to find that that was what he did in this case, especially when coupled with the defendant's admissions that he buys rock from drug dealers in the neighborhood. And just to make it absolutely clear, there was only one test done for sodium bicarbonate. The first time, the substance was tested for cocaine. The second time, it was tested for cocaine base, because the state labs test first for cocaine, then for cocaine base. The third time, after the Edwards decision came out, the substance was sent to see whether or not sodium bicarbonate was tested. And that was the process that the drugs went through in this case, three separate labs. That being said, once again, the sodium bicarbonate, we would urge, is not required for a finding of crack.
Turning to this whole warrant problem, don't we have a classic situation of the judge acting as a rubber stamp because the judge admitted that she couldn't, she had difficulty reading the warrant. No, she didn't follow her normal procedure. There was no signature.
No, this was not the judge acting as a rubber stamp. What this was a judge who had signed many warrants over the course of her career being asked 2 years later to remember this specific one. And that's why we'd urge you to look at Officer Del Bosque's testimony on the issue of what happened in the car in the parking lot when the judge was asked to sign the warrant, because the judge did admit that she could not remember this specific event occurring. What she was trying to do, and it's pretty clear if you read her testimony as a whole, is trying to parse together, based upon her standard practices, what she would have done, as well as what she knows did not happen. For example, she knows that for every single John Doe warrant, the John Doe has appeared before her and sworn out the warrant's contents. So that, coupled with Officer Del Bosque's testimony that he brought Cedric Ollie to the judge did swear him, that she went over a few portions of the affidavit with him, including the drug type, the address, she showed him a picture of the defendant. Those things together show that the judge, with respect to, you know, the most of her standard practice, it was followed. Now, we agree that the judge failed to correct a date on the bottom of the first page that she had corrected on the second page. She speculated that perhaps it was too dark in the car to remember that that first page, the date had been there. Apart from that, and the fact that Cedric Ollie did not sign the warrant, however, we know that he came before her. We know that he was available to answer questions for her. We know from Officer DeBosque's testimony that he did answer questions for her. That is enough to support a totality of the circumstances finding that she was not just merely acting as a rubber stamp.
Now, didn't the affidavit at least leave the impression that he had been purchasing crack from Lake for the past 10 years, and isn't there evidence that the officer knew that was not the case?
I think it's clear from reading the affidavit that this is not written by a brain surgeon or even someone who's doing SEC filings, as Mr. Duffy was talking about. This is not a corporation. This is not someone who probably has a college background who's writing this.
This is someone whose business it is to write these affidavits.
That's correct.
How often does it happen that state's attorneys are not involved in preparing these?
Truly, Your Honor, I have no idea. It's my understanding from this one that the state's attorney did not do it. The state's attorney certainly was not there. It was the police officer.
Right.
And I still feel that the statement is factually accurate. And if you look at the report, I know Cedric Ollie wasn't there to testify, but you can look at the complete report, which is attached to Mr. Duffy's brief as Exhibit A, of his interview. He met the defendant in 1985. Therefore, he has known the defendant for over 10 years. He has been buying crack cocaine from the defendant since he knew him. He had been buying for him at least 8 months. Actually, when he came in to speak with us on July 6th, he claimed that he had been buying from the defendant for the last 3 years, which, although factually inaccurate since the defendant was in jail for most of those 3 years, he'd been buying for at least the last 8 months. Whether or not he'd been buying since 1985, I think you can say that perhaps he had been. So it is a factually accurate to say I've known this person for over 10 years and I bought crack cocaine from them during that time. Whether you go with his statements to the police on the night the warrant was issued or to us in July, on both occasions he said that he had known the defendant for over 10 years and that he had bought crack cocaine from him repeatedly during that time. The defendant was a crack cocaine source of his, no matter which story of his you go with. And just bringing the court's attention to that, I can't tell you at this point that Cedric Ollie was accurate, but what I can tell you is the district court found the officers did not know he had a motive to lie. And while he may have had a motive to lie and he may have been lying, the point is the officers did not know that. The officers were relying on him. The judge was relying on him. And from its face, the warrant was supported by probable cause. For those reasons, unless there are further questions, we rest on our briefs and ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. You have 1 minute, counsel.
Briefly in rebuttal, it is not our position that people in the streets or users of crack cocaine cannot testify that a substance is in fact crack. Our position, I think, bolstered by Edwards and I think the 2001 Booker case, is that where you have chemical evidence showing the absence of chemical properties of crack, that cannot be overcome by the sort of ephemeral evidence that we have here. With respect to the warrant at issue, my colleague at the bar, Ms. Perry, invites the court to place faith in the issuing judge's procedures and the fact that she had issued several warrants. The problem with that is we have an alternative version of the events proffered by the confidential informant himself, who totally disavowed much of the contents of his warrant and basically said that the judge did nothing whatsoever to verify his version of events and ask him questions. If there are no further questions, we rest on our briefs, and I thank you for hearing us.
Thank you, counsel. And you took this case by appointment, did you? You have the thanks of the court for doing an excellent job in representing your client. Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement.